Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. Welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies, a channel of the New Books Networks. My name is Patricio Simonetto, and today we are talking with Professor Pablo Palomino. Pablo Palomino is an assistant professor in Latin American Caribbean Studies at Emory University. Today we will be talking about his last book, The Invention of Latin American Music, A Transnational History, published by Oxford University Press. Hello, Pablo.
Hi, Patricio. Good morning. Thank you so much for inviting me to this show.
Thank you for taking part in it. My first question is about if you could introduce the audience about your trajectory, your academic trajectory, and how did you get to the idea of this book about Latin American music?
Sure, with pleasure. This book is the result of a rewriting of my dissertation, which I wrote I finished in 2014 in Berkeley, in Latin American history, and which in turn was an idea I had in Buenos Aires, which is where I'm from, at the beginning of the 21st century. I was in Buenos Aires thinking about how to write a good social cultural history of music. At that time, I was thinking about Argentine tango and Brazilian samba, the two genres that I knew the most and better. But then as I did my doctoral studies, I realized that these were bits of a larger history that ended up what I call in the title of the book, The Invention of Latin American Music. So, you know, from an interrogation about music per se, music itself, I ended up writing and researching about the conceptualization of the category itself of Latin American music. So in a way, it has a history behind it. Now I would write it differently, but but it's done. It's here. So
well. It happens. It always happens. No? You want to rewrite a book, like you could write like infinite books about one topic,
about the same topic. Yes.
So something very interesting in the title of the book is this idea that you use about the invention. And I was talking to you before the podcast about why did you choose the idea of invention of Latin American music and not, for example, the making of Latin American music that will be a phrase that usually historians go through or use?
Well, that's a great question. And I thank you for posing it, because as you suggest, the idea of making has a more organic sense, the formation of something, whereas invention is more in the semantic realm of tricks or concoctions, something more, maybe more creative. When I think of the making of something as a historian, I think of E.P. Thompson's The Making of the Working Class, no, the formation or making of a social class in and to itself. In the case of Latin American music, I want to underline the invention in the sense that this is the history, not of an actual thing, but of a rhetoric and a set of perspectives and policies and arguments about a thing. The readers of the book will notice that I argue over and over about the differences, the contrasts, the uniquenesses, the uniqueness of each of the histories that lie behind each of the what we call Latin American genres or musical or poetic traditions. So there isn't a thing, a school, a tradition called Latin American music that we could identify as such. In fact, the idea of Latin American music was born and is still in contention with other ideas about music in the region. Of course, national musics. No, we talk about Brazilian music, or also like ethnically inflected musical traditions, like Afro-Cuban music. My point is, Latin American music, we shouldn't take it for granted. We should discuss the way in which we dispose our ears and our minds to listen certain musics as Latin American.
That's super interesting. Taking into account the last thing you say, how do you think that this book could contribute to rethink the notion of Latin American itself through music?
Well, in the same direction, I would say, okay, three things. The first is that I wanted to write about the region, the making of the region or the invention of the region, as practices, as the history of certain practices. Not as a history with capital H, not as a history of, although there are like important actors and institutions and events, but you could see this as a social cultural history of microscopic, sometimes microscopic practices that yet invent this notion of a regional musical tradition. The second point is that I wanted to discuss the region not as the mere addition of individual countries, but as a regionalist project. So how, from sometimes minuscule or national or sub-regional musical practices, and I can discuss later what do I mean by musical practices, we get to create the notion of a larger whole that even transcends the nations. And finally, I wanted to write a transnational history. So to integrate the nation, as the term transnational contains the nation in it, within a history of a region that typically we take for granted. We assume that Latin America exists, and if we work on Chilean history, we take for granted that Peruvian or Brazilian or Nicaraguan history is somehow related to the Chilean history we're writing. But this is just an assumption. We don't reflect on how and why and since when these different national or regional paths connect to each other. So in that sense, I wanted to write about music, but through music, to write about how we conceptualize the region as a whole. So that's why the book is a book about actors and institutions and narratives that somehow invented this idea that we share an identity, a regional identity, through music. The counter argument I wanted to unsettle here, no, the point I want to attack is the essential and sometimes romantic othering of Latin America. The ethnocentric assumption that it is an identity or a reality that is obvious, that has been there since the beginning of time as a natural occurrence. What I show in the book through music, and I think that other people can have or can show in other realms, is that the region is a project. It's a programmatic, utopian, if you want, or more concrete, pragmatic, political project of creating systems, creating narratives, creating mechanisms for this multiplicity of histories and peoples and identities to assert some kind of presence, force in culture, in politics, in economics, what we call Latin America.
That's super interesting. And there in the book, you argue that during the 30s, there was a huge change in this concept. I would love if you could explain us why. Why do you think that in the 30s, the idea of Latin American music changed? How do you think this concept evolved and changed during the 20th century, if there was one concept?
Yes, I think that the 30s are the key, although the book starts in the introduction, there's a reference to the 19th century, and in the first chapter, to the turn of the 20th century and the first decades. As you say, the 1930s are the key context. In the 1930s, there's a convergence of factors. The first is the idea of a crisis of civilization, a crisis in the European model for constructing a modern society. Even our often criticized Europeanist elites of the 1930s, they developed new ideas about how to build a state, how to build a nation, in dialogue, but also in contrast with these European models that after World War I, and especially with the global economic crisis, destabilize the older notions of progress and modernity. So my point is that is in among intellectuals, musicians, composers, cultural brokers, 1930s are a time of inventions, new ideas, a lot of conceptual creativity. And a second phenomenon is the dissemination of new intellectual networks, thanks to some, you know, technological innovations, but also through political and social changes that allowed a number of big I and small I intellectuals from big capitals, from provinces throughout the region to read each other, to travel, to through exile within Latin America and Europe and the United States, to read each other and think about the region in new terms. Even intellectuals that were ideologically nationalist or that were formed and oriented to national intellectual or political or educational systems. So I mentioned that the 1930s were a decade of creativity and crisis of older European notions of culture and civilization. Then there is a flourishing of intellectual networks of all kinds. And more importantly, we have national states in the 1930s sponsoring new cultural policies oriented towards the masses. Yes, this is the new vocabulary of the time. So these intellectual networks in a context of political creativity suddenly have official resources at their disposal to produce cultural projects. And here we have like the emergence, what I show in the book, the emergence of Latin Americanist musicology as part of a collection of national paths towards developing musical knowledge, musical pedagogies, and musical patrimony, and ethnographic research, collective singing, different musical practices around this idea of uplifting the masses. And this is something that is shared throughout the region by all the intellectual establishments across Latin America. So this is why the 1930s and 1940 and up until World War II, this is like the most important period, I think, for the invention of Latin American music. Then in the 1950s, what I show in the final part of the book, from the 1950s until today, we have a series of processes that reinforce this idea of Latin American music as representing the identity of a world region. In the 1950s, we have all these programs of regional development, like CEPAL or ECLA, among economists and then social scientists in the 50s and 60s. These regional / global agencies further developed the idea that Latin America is a region different from North America, from Africa, from Europe, from Asia. In the 1960s, 70s, and also 80s, we have a new generation of political and cultural activists who connect through the idea of revolution, of socialist revolution, especially after the Cuban Revolution, with this older tradition of musicologists from the 1930s and 1940s who had already been writing and researching about the culture of the people. Then in the 1990s, with the end of this developmental and revolutionary project of the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, we have the emergence of this notion in the United States, the Latino culture, Latino identity, Latino music, that became influential in the past 30 years, not only in the United States, but globally through the musical and cultural industry. But this notion of Latino music contains elements of all these previous eras. So we find this notion of Latino music in, you know, the area studies programs in which we work in England or in the United States. There are seeds of this previous history research planning around a region considered as a unity. Then we have seeds of these debates of the 1930s, these inventions of the 1930s, in, let's say, the work of Manu Chao, yes, or the Putumayo label record label in the 2000s. And if the listeners have paid attention to the Netflix documentary that recently was released by produced by Gustavo Santaolalla, this Argentine rock musician that now became a big Latino music producer, you know, this rhetoric of a region that is organically represented through music, even if well, in the case of rock music, like Santaolalla shows, there is a common tradition because it's the same genre in multiple countries, with, you know, Mexican musicians, rock musicians paying attention to the Argentines, the Chileans, and vice versa. But this is just an example of how, either in commercial or in academic or in romantic terms or a combination of all those, this invention was very successful. It's still informing the way we consider the region.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
That's super, super interesting because it connects your book with the present now. But going back to these musical policies that you were talking about and the role they played in the process of nation building in Latin America, or of reshaping of the nation building in Latin America. How do you think these musical policies, or which role they play, or what they could tell us about the race politics in Latin America?
Well, that's a great question, and it's a problematic question for me in particular, because of the history of the word race and the uses we have of it in academia, and the fact that I have never been a historian of race, but I was always a historian of music, culture, politics, but race was never my main angle. In fact, race is something I rediscovered in studying in the United States. No, and there's recently my professor Mauricio Tenorio in Chicago, recently in Historia Mexicana. There's a dossier with multiple articles on the 70th, I think, anniversary of the journal. He wrote about how we Latin Americanist scholars, we sometimes translate Anglo words, Anglo concepts, without much care, as if the translation had like a pristine meaning. So he referred to words like race, agency, that are words that in the Anglophone academia have like a very dense history of cultural and political traditions being sort of contained in the word itself. When we say raza in Latin America or race in Latin America, sometimes we need to do a translation. And I think that we can edit this rambling. My point is, I would say race was and is less important than the people in this history. Okay. These cultural policies, these intellectuals, musicologists, of course they had racialized ideas of who their audiences were, of the origins and meanings of music, but that was not the main point of their work. Race politics were part of wider political and socioeconomic programs that addressed entire national populations. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, in the case of tango, you'll see in chapter 3 there's a section on how the musicological and the union leadership. Mm-hmm. Ambience of Buenos Aires, of the tangueros in Buenos Aires in the 1930s, how they debated about how Argentine was tango. And the main debate there was among, on the one hand, the Hispanists, los hispanistas, or criollistas, the ones who argued about the native / Hispanic origins of the Argentine folk, the Argentine people, versus tangueros, these tango musicians and organizers that were in many cases the children of immigration, of Italian immigration, sometimes Spanish immigration, sometimes Jewish immigration. But the terms of the debate were around, even if the debate had like a racializing tone at times, the point was between us and them. You know, native-born versus foreigner. Honestly, race is not a useful category in that debate.
Well, I think that's a huge contribution. Somehow, if problematize the uses of this concept, even if the book don't explicitly problematize, but it does a lateral contribution to rethink mm-hmm. these processes in their own terms. You know? Like in this sense, it's another way of contributing to this kind of debates.
You're right. In fact, if you pay attention to the cover of the book, we have Ney Mato Grosso, the great Ney Mato Grosso. He's representing Latin America or South America in the Rock in Rio festival in 1985. He dressed up as an Indian, as an archetypical romantic Indian. No? So you can see race is always part of the conversation. Like ethnic and racial identities, of course. I mean, think of Cuban musicologists or Brazilian musicologists. The Africanness of Cuba and Brazil is always central to the conversation. But the points and the terms were less about race than about political inclusion of multiracial, multi-ethnic populations of artists or audiences that were intended to become Cubans or Brazilians or Argentines. Of course, it's completely valid and necessary and legitimate to write other histories that show how these nationalist attempts at inclusion contained like racist, central racist elements in them, so forms of neglecting or denying or erasing or invisibilizing entire sets of the population, entire histories and languages. But that's a different history. And in fact, I would say that if anything, what the invention of Latin American music shows is how in these political, pedagogical, cultural programs, a variety of subaltern, neglected identities were integrated, showcased, even embraced, as in the cover of the book. So I'm not arguing that race is not useful or is not important, or as some people say, it's not an issue in Latin America. To the contrary, it's absolutely central. But central in a way that is not necessarily the way we would assume through an Anglo academic perspective on the term itself, raza. I know that this might be polemic and people
No,
might,
no,
might
I think it's fantastic. It. And I think everything what you're saying is very interesting and contributes a lot to avoid projecting historiographical discussions from other latitudes to our context without thinking about the other ways of in which this process of a racialization can be working and can be creating other kind of conflicts. And that's interesting. It's not polemic. It's polemic in a good way. I think so. Also, going to the next question. But I think fantastic about your book is how by taking one topic, you can open discussions in multiple axes of Latin American history. And something that is very interesting and sometimes is not very well analyzed is the relationship between Latin America and the United States. And in your book, you wrote about this relationship. And I wanted to ask you what this book can tell us about this conflictive relationship between the United States and Latin American countries through music.
Well, thank you. That's a great question. And you're making me see that, the United States is present throughout the book. Like in every chapter, the United States is playing some kind of role. And the fact that we are having this conversation in English... It has to do with, it already tells us how the conversation about Latin America is mediated by the United States and by the English language perspective on the region. At the beginning in the 19th century, early 20th century, in the United States, Latin America was this weird, not very known other. Yes. In fact, you see that in the books that were published at the time, South America is more frequent than Latin America as a term. And South means from Mexico downward. Yes, so like south of the Rio Grande. The America that is not the America, the US America. By the 1930s, the problem of Latin America from the U.S. perspective was that Latin America was too European. In the musical scene, Latin America was too close to the German and Italian musical traditions and musical actors and institutions. This is why the Pan American Union, that had been created decades before, began to develop a music section in order to consolidate, you know, the good neighbor policy. But also, there was an actual attempt by New Deal musicologists, like left-wing Rooseveltian cultural brokers in the United States, to create a Pan-American musical brotherhood or a musical system. And there's an entire chapter on this, on how Charles Seeger developed a series of programs of about exchanging musical scores and tours and music education and conferences and publications around this idea of music of the Americas. In this sense, Latin America was just one part of a larger whole, which is the Americas. But then once the United States won World War II, they emerged as the victors, and they virtually forgot about these programs. And they, in fact, used them to develop their global agendas, many of which became part of UN projects like UNESCO. This is a history, you know, it's part of the history of the US deploying its global reach after World War II. But Latin America had, in Latin America were planted some of the seeds of that global ambition. Excuse me, that there's noise here. Since the 1950s on, as we know very well as historians of Latin America, the United States developed it had already done it before, but it became a more clear, an imperial relationship. We can define empire in multiple ways, but this is clearly an imperial relationship in terms of the very forms of knowledge that the United States developed about Latin America, markets, and of course military and intelligence policies. But you're asking me about music, and I would say that what's more important about music in this history is the fact that Latin American immigrants became in the past 50 years the largest immigrant population in the United States, no, the largest minority. It's like close to 20% of the U.S. population nowadays recognizes its origins somehow in what we call Latin America. And music was essential to this, essential to identifying, othering, romanticizing, including marketing this population. So you see how we have like a century of U.S. Latin America relations that can be approached from the angle of musical practices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, continue. Yeah.
No, from the Pan American Union to Gustavo Santaolalla recording albums in Los Angeles or Miami, and I was watching the other day this other. It's not Netflix, it's HBO, I think. This movie, In the Heights. It's a musical about Dominican and Latino, in general, immigrants in part of New York. And yes, this is another attempt at making sense. I think that the movie is not really successful because it's... it's not the point is not the movie, but... the music is, it's a musical film. So somehow to discuss Latino identity in the United States, whatever the perspective, whatever the argument, whatever we like it or not, music is central to it. Then we could discuss what music is used there. No, it's basically, it's Puerto Rican or Afro-Cuban music that stands for the entire Latino identity, because there are Mexican flags and South American flags there in the neighborhood. Of course, this is a silly movie, it's romantic, but you see how, I would say music is central to the images of Latin America in the United States, and central to the very images that Latinos in the US produce of themselves. And because of the imperial relationship between the United States and Latin America, music is central to the way we in Latin America, let's say in Argentina or in Uruguay or El Salvador, how we see each other as part of a common tradition. Mm. But again, this is, as you can see, a series of inventions rather than something organic.
I was thinking while writing your book about, well, the challenges of doing a transnational history that is complicated, thinking especially in history and archives. It would be interesting if you could talk a little about which kind of documents you work in the book, how you address them, and also something that for me was very interesting, that first, before reading the book, I was expecting to read more musical documents and search like songs. Like I imagined first, well, this is a book about music, so it will be a book about songs. And I found that you were working a lot with text-written documentary mm-hmm. sources. So if you could talk about this dimension of the book, would be interesting.
Well, that's a great question. I'm a historian, no? So I work primarily with written documents. Although I used to, every time I found a document or developed some of the threads of the book, I looked for musical traces too, to listen to and to include here and there some references. Music is something that is part of my everyday life. But you're right, this is a textual based book. I developed it in dialogue with several ethnomusicologists or, people who do a sort of an anthropological take on music. They are like cultural historians in a way of music. But the reader will find in each of the threads of the book documents that reflect some kind of musical practice. In some cases, those texts, those textual evidences that you mentioned refer to poetic traditions. In other cases, they reflect the idea that some composers or some musicologists have about what's the proper or the actual or the original music of a certain people. You will find in these texts evidence of how the states saw music as a way of shaping societies. You will find how music was central to the formation of the revolutionary armies of the Mexican Revolution, mm-hmm. Of cultural diplomacy during World War II, of regionalist rhetoric since the 1950s, or how intellectuals in the 1920s and 1930s traveling Europe found out that there was a thing called Latin America through the rumbas or tangos that they enjoyed in cabarets or dance clubs in, say, London, Berlin. So in a way, it's because this is not an encyclopedic take on Latin American music. This is not a book with a taxonomy and a history of each of the genres or traditions within Latin American music. No, this is an intellectual history of a category, Latin American music, as part of a larger cultural history of how musical practices shape our understanding of the region. So it's a how to explain this in the title of a book, in order to avoid tricking the readers, the shoppers, the book shoppers. I didn't know how to do it, but you know, I'm sorry if you didn't have the music you were expecting to have.
No. I think that is amazing. Like how you can do a history of how we experience music through textual documents, and I think that's a huge contribution to think cultural history of Latin American cultural history in general. I was going to ask you something related with this cultural perspective that you were talking about, that something I really enjoy about your book, what I think is attractive for many things beyond history and about people interested in Latin America in general, is how you introduce cultural critics and cultural study into the field. And I'm thinking in particular in the figure of Carlos Monsiváis, for example, that you are all the time, we're talking about Mexico, bringing him as a... and somehow in the middle between the documentary sources and at the same time a scholar with which you're establishing a dialogue. How do you think that this kind of production could be integrated into historical narratives and analysis about Latin American cultures?
Well, that's it. I'm very glad that you noticed that because we historians typically read each other, but we don't necessarily read anthropologists, sociologists, literary critics, or cultural critics. And because they do stuff differently, they do other stuff, and you know, professionalization demands from us like a specialization in a certain field, in a certain narrative form, and in a certain tradition of texts. But I think that I love reading intelligent minds in other fields, and especially if my goal was to understand Latin America as a region, I needed to go beyond my own historiographic field. So yes, Carlos Monsiváis in particular is interesting because he wrote in the year 2000, I think, a book called Aires de Familia, in which he sort of says a little bit what I'm trying to say here, but he's said it 20 years earlier from a different angle. And of course, he's more like an ensayista, no? He writes essays that are like, seem like a bit more loose than our supposedly, you know, tight, controlled academic arguments. But he shows how at the level of popular poetry and through cinema and the radio and literature in the first half of the 20th century, Latin American readers and consumers and artists slowly began to share a sort of commonality, this aires de familia, this sense of relating to each other around certain tropes of melodrama, certain forms of spirituality. Cultural tropes that you see circulating. And he, in fact, pointed already to the influence of Hollywood in this circulation of forms of femininity and masculinity and forms of love and passion that began to inform the everyday experience of Latin Americans. Something that is like Beatriz Sarlo in The Empire of Sentiments, El Imperio de los Sentimientos. It's a book written in 1980-something. She already showed how, you know, this young girls working for the first time in an office in downtown Buenos Aires and taking the tramway would learn how to see themselves and enjoy their or suffer or process their sentimental and sexual lives through these folletines, no? This serialized stories that were read in magazines. These are insights from other forms of cultural history that in the case of this book I learned from and I dialogue with, because I found out that in Mexico and Brazil and Argentina, which are the countries that I where I conducted most of the research. Music was an important topic of conversation for all kinds of actors. And traces of these conversations can be seen now in other fields, no? in other books. I don't know if I'm answering your
question. I think you're doing pretty well. And just to finish or to lead to a more present conclusion to think with your book, I was going to ask you, taking into account what you were talking about, the explosion of Latin American music and Latinx and in the Anglo-Saxon scenario, but in all the world, even in Asia, we know now that Latino music is in the top charts, for example, in Spotify. Like, what do you think about this explosion of Latin American music or Latinx music? Or if there is any connection between this this aesthetics that you described there in your book that are these people are trying to bring together to create this notion of we're facing a new explosion of new aesthetics related with the idea of being Latin America or being Latino in US. Mm-hmm. What do you think about it?
Well, that's a great question because it introduces another concept, Latinx, which, like race or like any other concept or Latin American music itself as a category, it requires a proper situation, no, a contextualization. I would say Latinx, in my experience as a teacher and citizen in the U.S. nowadays, citizen in the not as a bureaucratic category, but as a being. Developing my life there, I try to be a good citizen in the general sense, of course. I would say that based on that experience, Latinx is an identity developed by a new generation of activists and thinkers, but very young people. When you look at the demographic research and how people identify, what terms people use in the United States to identify themselves or their group, Latinx is dominant, is more clearly focused on young people, like and young people in college. So there's a quite specific origins to the term. This is a generation of not even millennials. I would say like Gen Z people. Who are growing politically in the United States, seeing racist structures, white supremacy, the legacy of racial inequalities are shaping their own lives, and learning about the specific history of Latin American relations with the United States, and Latinx, I think is a direct product of this. Consciousness, which is also inflected by a new sexual and gender set of politics, with the X pointing to the indetermination or the fluidity or the openness or the inclusivity, the inclusiveness of gender. Now, this demographic political conversation sometimes connects with the evolution of the musical markets in the United States that are developing this with people like Santaolalla and many others, the Grammy Latinos and many other labels and institutions developing an idea of Latin America as a label, Latin music as a commercial label, and also as you pointed out. The U.S. music industry developed a global system of musical commerce and dissemination through Spotify and other forms of software for music consumption. That it has rippling effects all over the world. So in this way, U.S. concoctions of what they call Latino or now Latinx music connects with the understandings of what Latino or Latinx means in Latin America, in China, in Europe, in Africa, in Asia in general. So this is history in the making, really. So I would say, Patricio, that this final question points to what can we historians contribute to current conversations about what is Latin America?
Totally. Pablo, thanks for joining us. I'm very excited, and I invite all the audience to buy this book, to read it. And I think it's like an excellent contribution, especially for teaching Latin American studies and Latin American history. So, thanks.
Thank you, Patricio. Gracias a vos. It was a pleasure.